This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Maignan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblé.
And our topic today is...
Security and Internet of Things.
Oh, nice. We don't really have any follow-up this week, but we wanted to talk a little bit about some upgrades that we've been doing on our computers recently. So why don't you start?
Yeah, I'll start because mine will be quick. So I have finally updated my last computer that was not up to date, which was my personal iMac. So this computer went from 10.8 to 10.10, and I'm already planning to migrate to El Capitan. Maybe not on the betas, but maybe like when 10.11 is out. Like the second it's out, I'll just move to it.
Now, so, you've been using 10.10 at work on your work computer, right?
Yes.
So it's not entirely new either.
No, but there was tons of not legacy stuff on my iMac, but maybe just old dusty stuff. And I won't say that the migration was rocky, but just like there's still stuff I need to clean again. And it's been a while since I have done some cleanup on this computer, and I'm too lazy to do it. So I guess at some point I should do it.
Yeah. I can relate to that somewhat.
Yeah, and also, I heard that you are now running betas on some of your devices.
Right, so I'm running iOS 9 on my phone and watchOS 2 on my watch.
Courageous guy.
Well, that's not all. I also entered the brave new world of iCloud, so my photo library is now entirely in iCloud photo library, which has been a little bit worrying recently because it still isn't working for me. And I also switched from Documents and Data to iCloud Drive. So I joined up to two iCloud services this week and jumped in, and I'm hoping that it turns out well in the long term. So yeah, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I do. So maybe the first one is, I don't remember if you were using Aperture or not.
Yeah, I was using Aperture.
So it was an Aperture migration to Photos.app, right?
Correct.
Good. So yeah, I'm planning to do that at some point. But beforehand, what I want to do first is do some cleanup there.
And yeah, that's what I did. I wanted to see how low I could get my photo library to be before determining if I wanted to upgrade my iCloud storage at all. And it turned out that I got in very close to 100 gigs. So I had to get the 200 gig plan on iCloud to fit my entire library in the cloud. It uploaded over 2 days. And the problem that I'm having right now is that until very shortly before we started recording, my photos in the cloud didn't actually show up on any of my devices except my Mac, where they were stored locally. So I had zero confidence that they were actually in the cloud, which is a bad thing when you're using a cloud service. But right before we started recording, some photos started showing up on my iPad, and I haven't actually checked my phone, so I don't know if they're showing up on my phone, but it took basically a day and a half for anything to show up on any of my devices, which is worrisome. It's not the best first experience, I would say.
No, and it feels to me that they're kind of doing some process or maybe data replication that takes so much time to do. And I don't know what they are currently doing after the upload, but this is really strange.
But the problem is, like, I've seen what it looks like on my grandma's computer. And on my grandma's computer, when she did the migration, it worked instantly. It's just, for me, it didn't work instantly. It took a good 2 or 3 days for, I gave it the entire time to upload before turning it on my devices. But once I turned it on my device just got sort of stuck in the state. Like, you can go see the current photo sync state in the settings app. And I went to go check it, and it was always stuck at the same place. And there's no cancel button or pause button or anything in that menu. You just sort of have to hope that it gets out of it someday. And I guess it did, but I'm not sure what's going on.
And what was the size of your grandma's photo library?
It was much, much smaller, but I don't remember what it was.
Okay.
I think it fits in the free plan, so that should give you a good idea.
Yeah. So it could explain why you ran into some issues, but even then, it's weird because those kind of issues are kind... I wouldn't say that you're the first to run into, but like maybe you're some of the lucky ones that ran into them, because as far as I remember, people that did the migration, for most people, it went pretty well. Like, it was not as bad as the Apple Music fiasco that is happening right now. But everybody was mostly in agreement that iCloud Photos was pretty good.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything bad about iCloud Photo Library as a service. I've heard bad things about the experience on device, namely when you bring up the photo picker, and if you're not on iOS 9, it takes an eternity to pop up. But I don't have this problem, of course, because the iPad didn't even see my photos until very recently. So I haven't actually tried to bring up the photo picker since I've gotten my photos to show up on my iPad.
And did you run into any issues? You could have not run into issues because I was about to ask if you ran into issues with iOS 9 and still using Yosemite on your Mac. Because if you have read the release notes for LCAP betas, they mentioned that the second you open your library with the new Photos app, let's call it version 2 in LCAP, it's a one-way migration.
Oh, really?
Yes. So the LCAP Photos.app library is not compatible with the Yosemite version.
But is that the file format or is that what's in the cloud?
To be honest, I don't know because the release notes are pretty unclear about that. They just say that the file won't open.
Okay.
But does it mean that it is because of some change that is also affecting the cloud? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that the cloud is fine because I think that, well, we'll see because, like, my phone, as I said, still isn't showing up with my cloud photos. So perhaps it's living in a different universe than the rest of my devices are. But otherwise, the only issue that it's not really an issue because I don't use that app, but the Notes app, when you first launch it, asks you if you want to do a one-way migration that will break compatibility with previous OSs in order to enable all the new features that they've added, namely inline link previews and stuff like that, checklists. All of that basically breaks sync with previous versions. And behind the scenes, as far as I know, it uses CloudKit instead of using IMAP like they were doing before. So it makes sense that it breaks compatibility, but I don't use that app and I don't plan to use that app. So I couldn't really call that an issue. What I would call an issue is the watchOS upgrade process, if you can call it that. Not only is it really, well, I understand they have to make things weird because it's a developer beta and they don't want people to randomly wind up in the beta when they shouldn't be. Although that never really stopped anyone. But it took an entire afternoon for me to upgrade my watch to watchOS 2. It took somewhere upwards of 2.5 hours for my watch to, from iOS 9 finished download and install to actually finished install of watchOS 2 on my watch. It took 2.5 hours, if not more.
So this only includes the download period from the phone to the watch and then the install process on the watch. So no download time from internet to your phone.
No. It's the time that it took to download the entire watchOS 2 firmware on the phone, transfer it, and install it.
Oh, I see.
It took 2.5 hours, which is sort of a big deal. Because we've been talking a lot about like how they should be trying to make iOS version smaller and all of that stuff. And I feel like the same issue is happening again with the watch, and that's not good.
Yeah, and it is especially stressful with the watch, because if something bad happens with the watch, you just need to mail back your watch to Apple.
Yeah, you can't really do anything about it yourself, which is a problem.
And I even think that you cannot go to the Apple Store for that. Like, I don't think they'll know what to do.
I think it depends what level of Apple Care you have. I think I saw someone tweeting about this recently. But basically, if you have Apple Care Plus, they are tied to the device that you have or something. Anyway, I'm not sure what the specifics are, but I think it may have something to do with Apple Care level, which is strange. And we'll talk more about this in the next episode, where I plan to talk more about this kind of upgrade cycles and those kinds of things in a cloud computing world. But I think that the watch is a very early device and that it has the potential to get a lot of updates because it's a rapidly evolving product category. The problem is if the upgrade process doesn't get much, much better, I don't think people are going to put up with this shit very long.
What do you mean? Because I think developers will have to put up with it, even if Apple doesn't want to change. But I guess that's for another discussion.
The first thing is, like, I don't know if my experience was worse because I was going from watchOS 1 to watchOS 2 beta something. I don't know if they do Delta updates. If they do Delta updates, it may actually be a lot better from watchOS beta, whatever we're on right now. I think it's beta 5 to beta 6. If the time is greatly reduced, then who cares? My complaint is more or less only valid for the developer period. But I mean, if Apple goes through a similar pace to what they've done with iOS 8, where they have 8.1, 8.2, 8.3, 8.4 in a rapid succession over the course of a year, and maybe point updates with bug fixes and all that stuff. If they have that same schedule on the watch, people are going to get fed up of having to take their watch off for 2.5 hours every couple of weeks to do a software update. They're just going to be like, especially if it's just bug fixes or something and there's no meaty content for them to see in the upgrade, people are just going to get fed up and stop updating their watches, I believe.
Yeah, you might be right. But if I recall correctly, the first update, the watchOS 1.0.1, if I recall correctly, or 1.1.
Yeah.
Whatever. This first update that we got for watchOS 1 was pretty fast to install, as far as I remember. And you might be right that it's only part of the beta process, because recently I had to update my LCAP install on my work computer, and I did the install back in June, so I had El Capitan beta 1, and now we're at beta 6, and I'm sure you can imagine what happened. I had to install every beta one after the other, so yeah. Imagine going from 1 to 2. So you need to download about 2 gigs. So each beta is about 2 gig each. So you download 2 gigs and then it installs. 2 gig install, 2 gig install. So I guess they might work less on those Delta updates for now. And then when they have a GM release ready, then they'll do the optimization to make sure that they can do the Delta updates for any platforms. And I hope so. It will be for any platform.
Yeah. And there are a lot of things that Apple can do that basically would take things that require updates today and turn them into things that don't require updates to the entire operating system. And we're going to explore those more in the next episode, because I have a lot of things to say about that and I don't want to eat up all of the time in your episode this week. But it was interesting within the context of watchOS, where I think a lot of the things in watchOS 2 are fairly minor and there's no real excuse for it to be 2.5 hours. Well, I say fairly minor. It's fairly minor for me right now because I can't actually get any native apps other than my own running on my own watch. But it's still a significant upgrade if you take into consideration that there's basically every iOS framework in there.
Good, so let's stop teasing your next episode and let's just end that small segment by saying that both of us had funny experience updating software. So for once, recently, mine was pretty straightforward. And yes, I haven't updated to iCloud Drive or all of those iCloud services yet, but mine were pretty straightforward and you had a rough time.
Well, only to get photos to work.
Okay. Good. So now let's jump into my subject. So at the top of the show, I mentioned that topics this week will be security and Internet of Things. And I wanted to talk about that today because in the recent maybe a month or two, I tried to immerse myself in the world of especially home automation. So the first product I bought is, I don't remember its name, but I kickstarted a smart lock, which hasn't shipped yet, but obviously it's just a Kickstarter product. But the biggest addition to my home setup is the Philips Hue product. And I'll skip all of the part of just like speaking about the configuration and just jump where the internet part of that product comes. So I haven't still configured it to be accessible via the internet. So right now, and just to be a small, quick background on what's Philips Hue. So Philips Hue is lights and lights fixture that are connected to a Philips Hue bridge. And this bridge can be connected to your Wi-Fi and your internet connection. And obviously this means that you can control your lights via an iPhone app and a watch app, and also via the internet. So wherever you are in the world, you can turn on and turn off the lights. And there's tons of nice features, and Philips has built a good API as far as I know right now. And they are pretty open to do integration. And the biggest one that I know right now for the Philips Hue is the AIFTTT software platform that could talk to your Philips Hue setup. And I started to think about what might be the problem of enabling that feature, like as a security perspective. Because obviously, this means that I'm currently opening a door to my home network. And I started to think about what could happen if this falls into the wrong hands. And yeah, this means at some point that somebody could have access to my lights and just play tricks on me. But as you listener may know, and obviously Yannick may know about myself, I'm a big car guy and a car nerd for us. And as my CarPlay episode shown, I'm also really into tech in the car. So lately, the Automatic, which is an ODB dongle that you can plug in your car, and it will give any dumb car some nice Internet of Things feature, like mileage, speed warning, car location in a parking, and stuff like these. Like, it's really like to improve your driving experience and improve how you drive, your gas mileage, and all of that stuff. And the Automatic, I've started an international beta program, which if I recall correctly, is supposed to be in. I don't know, there's like, it's kind of vague, yeah, right now. So, but yes, they are thinking about shipping those outside of the US, and this should happen in the coming months. It felt, small tangent here, it felt like a Kickstarter, not on Kickstarter, but oh well. But yeah, so if we're back into the fact that I'm really into tech in the car, like there's big opportunities to, like, as the same way as home automation, there's big opportunities in the automotive industry to just improve the car experience. Whichever is driving a car, like owning a car, and all of that stuff. And before I go on the other side of things, like about security and all of those products I spoke about, I would like to ask you if you right now own any Internet of Things devices. And just to make it clear, right now, it's more like, do you own any internet connected devices that are not computers, tablet, or mobile phone?
No.
Okay, that's good. No, that's fine.
Well, like, excluding game consoles.
Yeah, okay. I kind of forgot to mention those, but I was including them. So yeah, you don't have any maybe home automation stuff or any gadget that should not have internet in it that right now has an internet version of it, if you see what I mean.
No, because I tend to believe that the things that don't have the internet in them don't really need to have the internet in them, and therefore we don't really need to have them in the house.
Okay, that's fine. But yeah, so like I just said, I wanted to talk a lot about car tech, and the recent weeks have been really interesting on the topics of security and car technology. Obviously, if there's vulnerabilities that can be found by the wrong kind of people, this has big impacts. Much worse impact compared to somebody has hacked my Philips Hue setup. This could mean that somebody could have access to the car while I'm driving, for example, or a lesser impact could be that somebody could just steal a car, but at least my life won't be in danger. So in the recent weeks, we've seen a couple of examples that shown that our cars are getting more tech in them, but are getting less secure. And the tech inside of them is not to make them more secure, but just to improve the car owning and the car experience as a whole. So let me go through a couple of examples. And it's funny because those examples have been, mentioned a lot on Wired. I will put those article in the show notes. But their security portion of Wired has been great over the summers. Andy Greenberg had three topos about three examples I will give you. And the first one, which made the news, I think first, let's just put it that way, but the biggest one in my opinion, is using the infotainment system on certain Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram vehicles. An hacker or a person that wants to just play some weird games, I don't know, so let's just call it an hacker. So somebody could take control of certain feature of your car remotely via the cellular network, because the infotainment system is connected on the Sprint network, if I recall correctly, but the network doesn't care. So those two researchers were able to show that they were able to change the radio frequency on the infotainment system, disable all of the buttons in the infotainment system, but they were also able to show that they were able to use the infotainment system to connect themselves into the car's network. And just to give the listener a backstory, each car has its own network where all of the electronics talk to each other. I don't call myself an expert on electronics and computers and cars, but I have the curiosity to just learn about it. So I'll try to keep it simple and don't make stupid mistake. And if I do, I'm sorry. I'll try to correct myself in the next episode. But yeah, so this infotainment system this infotainment system is on the same network, the same internal network where, for example, the engine computer is, where the transmission computer is, where's the brake controllers. So they could send remotely commands to those parts and make them behave in a life-threatening behavior. And I was like, last night I was reading their paper because they went, they finally released their paper because they wanted to show their findings. I don't remember the name of the conference. I think it's the Black Hack? I think the one in Las Vegas. It's Black Hack, right?
I think there are several in Las Vegas.
I think it's Black Hack. So the one in Las Vegas during summer. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, they're all one after the other. That's the other problem, is that you keep getting mixed up between like Black Hat and what's the other one? DEF CON. Like at the same place, like one after the other, and it's very confusing.
But yeah, so I'm still sorry. A conference about security in Las Vegas during August, the beginning of August. And those two researchers, one named Charlie Miller, has been pretty vocal about his findings on the internet. Like, he tweeted so much about some parts that he used on his Jeep and went back to the dealership and said, like, oh, I don't know why, but my infotainment system is acting weird. Can you change it for me or can you do something? And they always find a way because the dealership doesn't know what's happening. It's like, okay, he's using the dealership is using the old mantra of, it's broken, let's just replace it, and that's it. And yeah, that researcher is always making the joke like, yeah, he's playing dummy, but he knows why this piece is broken in the infotainment system. So that's really funny. Those two guys that did the research for the Uconnect system are pretty open about their findings. And after the conference, they released, and Charlie Miller posted this PDF on his Twitter account. And seriously, if you're like interested about the deep details of this hacking procedure, I would strongly suggest you to read it. And it's like, I think like 95 pages. And even if sometimes it's a little bit complex, the vocabulary and the way it was written is really like light. So it's really easy to follow and easy to understand. So right now, these days, it was in my opinion, the biggest hacking example that we got. The second one is also worrisome because there's a recent trend in the car insurance companies where they want you to buy or just give you a free OBD dongle that you plug in your car, and this dongle will analyze your driving behavior. And when you have good driving behaviors, it will reward you by lowering your monthly price for your insurance. And another group of researchers were able to use that dongle to cut the brake on the Corvette. And they were mentioning, yet again on the Wired article, that since it's a dongle that is connected to this standard port on any cars that has been built since 95, they could send commands to any car on the world that has that dongle. The only thing they know is they need to find which command to send, which will change from one car manufacturer to another.
But surely and within a manufacturer, it'll be standard.
Yeah, it could be standard-ish. Like, you can find some. And obviously, for some manufacturer, it could be easier to reverse engineer than others. For example, if you're a Canadian or American, it might be harder for you to try to reverse engineering a BMW ECU, which, as far as I know, all of them have like German terms in them. So they kind of use this security by obscurity part, but I'll talk about that later. I'll quickly round up with my last example, which was on GM OnStar remote link system. And this system is just a quick way to remotely unlock the doors, remote start the car during winter. So this feature is pretty useful because obviously, who wants a cold car during winter? Nobody. Seriously, nobody. So it's pretty nice to just remote start the car and 15 minutes later, you have a warm car. We'll drop the fact that it's not good for Earth, but bear with me for a sec. So this guy was able to show that because of security vulnerability in the iOS or Android app, so in the mobile app, he was able to use Wi-Fi, I think it was some kind of Wi-Fi monitoring system that he could put on the car. And if it was able to detect any signal sent by the application, it was able to grab the credentials. And then this Wi-Fi dongle was connected on the cellular network and then send those captured credentials back to the hacker. And then at that point, the hacker could do anything with those credentials. And at this, yet again, it could remote start your car, unlock the door. So it's more on the I can steal your car side and not I'm going to kill you with your own car side. So now that we are all scared at shit, because seriously, even if I enjoy driving, I was like, after that, I just want to hide myself in the basement and don't own a car anymore. Because we don't know what will happen. Like, you could be driving, and if you take a look at the video on the Jeep infotainment article on Wired, the guy was in his living room and was sniffing cars on the Sprint network. And was like, oh, this car is in Texas and we're in New York. I don't remember the right cities, but something like that. Like, I'm at some place in the country and on the other side of the country, I can see that there's a Jeep Cherokee of this year that is currently driving at 100 kilometers per hour at this latitude and this longitude. And if I want, I could just start sending commands and start the wipers, disable the brakes, start honking for no reason remotely. So I could see why people start to put tin hat on their head and start to freak out about cars. But consumers should do something about it. And maybe other developers and other companies, maybe software companies or hardware manufacturers that are better at software should maybe not share, but maybe the competitive aspect of doing business might affect the way that some other manufacturer should do their business. But in a way, we need to do something about it. And first point we need to do something about it is we need to make sure that hardware manufacturers start to care more about software. Because obviously, most car manufacturers and most companies that start to do home automation or any Internet of Things, those companies in the past were doing hardware. They were, yes, they were doing software, if you can say that they were having some chips in those hardware pieces that contains a firmware stuff. But they are not used to do soft user-facing software, let's call it this way. And still now, they don't have good incentive to bring power on software.
For well, example, hang on a sec.
Go on.
If you had the choice between car companies putting their power behind security of their existing bad software or behind a better user interface for their insecure software, which one would you choose?
That's a
like
good
in
question.
An ideal world, it would be both, but it won't.
Yeah, and indeed. And I think my, let's put it that way, the geek part of my brain will say the first one. So I would like to use a shittier experience, but a more secured one, especially if I know that this one could not kill me while I'm driving my fucking car. But my more, like, the other part of my brain is like, yeah, I want the shiny new UI. I want the shiny new feature. I want my iPhone to be able to use CarPlay on an infotainment system from my Ford car, for example, and not being stuck with the sync system that I'm currently using, which, I don't know, like, I'm not assuming it's more secure, but it might be more secure than the new infotainment system that supports CarPlay. But hey, CarPlay is good. I want it. So I'm sure the point you were driving at is most people will want to have a good UI, a good software in those hardware, but won't think too much about security. They will start to think about security when those papers start to come out, but even for the general population, they will start to think about it when somebody dies, sadly.
Well, it's not even just that. It's sort of like the malware situation and the virus situation on Windows, where people think, oh, well, I'm not a target, so no one's going to attack me. When in reality, what happens in the PC world is these giant botnets basically try to infect everyone to have a bigger botnet, and then your computer gets infected and maybe your data gets harvested, but there was never a specific attack on anyone. But try explaining that to normal people and they just don't even understand the concept of what is going on. So in the context of the car thing, people would say, well, nobody would have any reason to hack into my car because I'm not a criminal or involved in a drug war or something like that. So they would think, oh, well, even if there is an insecure issue in my car, the chances of someone hacking into my car are low enough that I'm willing to take the risk and have the shiny new toy instead.
No, and you're totally right about that. And the problem related to that is right now, those hacking procedures becomes not easier, but more interesting now that we are introducing quote-unquote intelligent feature on our car. Especially the Jeep research shown that feature like keep lane assist, self parking were feature that were was interesting to those researchers, because they're like, if the car is able to self park, this means that there's a computer in the driving system, like in the direction system, that could be controlled via the CAN bus, which is the network on our cars. And this also means that, like, the steering wheel is accessible via a certain unknown API, but via sending messages. So those new features start to become more present in our cars. And the main reason why those features become more present is for security. So we're introducing new features on our cars for the reason of security, but those features introduce more way to make the car insecure as a whole. So obviously when you're driving the car and nobody's interacting with it via a remote hack, like lane keep assist is really good, or like intelligent cruise control is really good if you want to keep a safe distance between the car in front of you and blah, blah, blah. But if those features, and that's what we're currently seeing, those features could bring new doors for hackers to use them and bring new opportunities for them to do bigger damages.
Yeah, well, those features are for protecting yourself from yourself, whereas the way they're being used by the hackers is as weapons against you. Basically, they're weaponizing the features to protect you from yourself, which is clever, I guess. I have a question for you. Do you believe that we are eventually going to wind up in a society where everyone is in self-driving cars, which have to be networked to even work, and therefore all of this is going to be an issue permanently?
To be honest, I'm still forging my opinion about that. Recently, I was listening to another one of the car podcasts, and was it the car podcast or YouTube videos? I don't remember who else, but it was an interview, and the interviewer asked this question to the interviewee, and the interviewee came to the conclusion that maybe in 10, 15 years, you'll have like all of the population will have self-driving cars. And in the coming years, what will happen is you'll get incentivized to get a self-driving car. Like, if you drive your own car, this will become expensive because you're introducing risk. A human is driving a car. A human is not reliable. So you need the human that wants to have this liberty should pay for this liberty compared to a car that is known to be crash free, quote unquote, that is able to like make sure that nobody in it, like, or they're like a 99.99 chance that this car won't be in a crash, whichever situation you throw at it.
Yeah, and if you believe the situation where Google takes over the world and every car is a self-driving car that is owned by Google, Google can do some clever things, like have all of their self-driving cars talk to each other on its own networking technology and ensure that those cars never run into each other. Something that you can't really do when humans are driving the cars because, A, you can't communicate with that many human beings at once from behind your dashboard, and two, it requires everyone to be of good standing, basically, whereas computers don't care. They're just going to do what they're programmed to do. So I think that those kinds of arguments make it fairly obvious that there is an advantage in, well, A, self-driving cars, period, but B, also these large pools of self-driving cars, which can be used by the mass, but are behind either a large government entity or a corporation like Google. Or I guess now it's Alphabet, maybe. I don't know what part of the company that is now.
But it's funny that you mention a company like Google. And this brings me to my second part of my point that hardware manufacturer needs to care about software. Is that now software companies, not what we used to consider software companies, are inserting themselves in the hardware market. And like, I haven't driven a Tesla, but as far as I heard, they are catching up on the hardware, on the automotive industry, pretty fast. And they are bringing new features that even luxury car right now don't have, for example. Like, a luxury car at the same level as their cars don't have. So, and I think, like, maybe I'll go on a small tangent on explaining why I think the software industry, the software companies that are catching up with the hardware industry, are able to do so. And I think it's related to the software perspective as a whole. Like, those companies were kind of forced to improve on themselves, and it's easier to improve on software and to do that more frequently than on hardware. So they have built this culture of just, there's something to fix, we'll fix it now, and this will bring us value now and not when we buy a new car with the fix, for example. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think that it is that culture that makes those software companies that enter those markets with great software. And maybe in the first years with okay hardware, but maybe 5 years from now, they are able to have like great hardware at the same level as the other competitor in their market. And Tesla is a good example of that. Like, remember what people were saying about the Tesla Roadster, which was based on Lotus Elise. They didn't build that car, all of the car on it, on their own. They used some part from the shelf, and they were added it with Lotus to get a chassis and all of that stuff. And now they have moved and they learned, they add their expertise to expertise to create their own Model S and new models. I don't know if it was way faster, but maybe they were able to learn on the experience of those hardware competitors in a different way that those hardware competitors are not able to learn from those software companies.
Yeah, it also helps that Elon Musk has a bunch of money.
Yeah, but maybe if we talk about Tesla for a bit, like, don't forget that Tesla had a rough time at its beginning. Like,
oh, definitely. But I would say that the Tesla Roadster is a very, very promising proof of concept to show off to people to get the right hires interested in your project to then make what Tesla is now possible. Like, I don't think if the Roadster would have been, like, this pathetic little proof of concept, like, a lot of electric car startups basically end up looking like, I don't think it would have gotten the attention of the people that they hired to make Tesla what it is today.
And maybe that's part of why software companies have this culture of being able to interest people, and then if they're able to capture the right people and bring the right talent, they're able to iterate faster. And you're touching on another point that is kind of what I was thinking about. That is, if our manufacturer needs to be better at software, they need to find a way to do it fast and also good. But it's hard to do both at the same time.
Right. Well, I think that the structure of something like a Tesla is, we have the software team and we value their work. So you, the hardware team, can work on the hardware, but we're going to let the software team flourish within this box you give them. And on top of that, I'm pretty sure that basically everything in the Tesla is programmable in some way, because, like, they keep pushing out updates to the car itself, and it affects more than just the UI on the dashboard, but, like, the entire car. And that's a really good thing. If you go with the software first approach and then say the hardware is basically a slave to the software, then you can get a lot more rapid iteration on the software front that way than in car companies, where it's basically, okay, build the entire car, and then when it's time, let's go talk to the software people about what they can do with the specific platform that we built for them, and then they can build this thing with a limited budget and a limited time scale because we don't value their work as much as a software company would. So I think that it's that attitude towards hardware benefits software, but, like, in car companies, they don't think of it that way. They think, well, software is a value add on top of this already stellar hardware, which is true to some way, but it's like they don't put all their effort behind it.
Let me go on another small tangent here, and it's not related to the subject, but do you think that maybe our own opinion right now is influenced because we are software people?
Well, definitely.
Yeah, obviously. It was something I was thinking about while writing my notes. I was like, okay, I totally agree with that point that our manufacturer sucks about software. But is it just the hardware guy speaking here, or they do have a point? We do have a point here. And I think the point we're trying to make is, if they care more about software, let's just say that they were not, like, I would say that those are easy vulnerabilities. But for example, a tweet that I found recently was like, the guy says, for shit and giggles, I port scanned my wife's new Cadillac. Both FTP and HTTP are open. Why the fuck are GM shipping an infotainment system with HTTP and FTP open?
Yeah, and shortly after that, did you see the tweet about the network accessible rifle that they sell now?
I don't think so.
There's a gun that has an app in the App Store and the Android thing where you can go in and log in and shoot your gun remotely. The problem is it has a default root password that anyone can hack in, basically. And I think, like, the response to that was like, well, try not to be around potential hackers when you're trying to use this app. And I was okay.
Now I remember. Like, they were mentioning, like, okay, so the Wi-Fi range is about 100 feet.
Yeah, something like that. So try not to be around hackers.
Yeah, now I remember. Yeah, so that was funny too. So, like, yet another example, which is not car related. Yeah, and also part of the G-Pack, I seriously always go back to this one, because to me right now, this is the biggest example we have of what software should have done and what is the problem is, and in this act, part of it is they are trying to access a specific port, which is known to be either RRC or D-Bus, which, as far as I understood, is a like inter-process communication protocol on Unix platform. That's what I understood, and from Wikipedia, I'm kind of right, but
that sounds right to me.
Yeah, I still need to look at it because it's really interesting. And they were able to just use that protocol to send commands to the infotainment unit. And more people started to tweet to those two researchers and saying, for example, that, let me take a look. It's the new Toyota, the Toyota Touch and Go exposed that same port. I don't know if this one is exposed publicly on the cellular network, for example, but as far as I know, it's at least exposed inside the Wi-Fi access port that the car can create for itself and for its passengers. And there's a small research that is showing about that, oh, you can tweak the infotainment system on Toyota because of that. Because obviously this protocol can use authentication, but obviously there's no one configured right now. And it was the same example for the Jeep infotainment system. So it's just like, we want to try to think that they are still aware about those issues, which for some seems like trivial, right? Like, there's an open port. Maybe you should put security on it to make sure that not everyone can connect on it and send commands via it. But I guess it's not trivial enough or something. And maybe that's like a true on hard bug and it was shipped without knowing, and that's fine. But this brings me to my second point of what we can do is, if there's no one listening when somebody is yelling about those problems, we need to provide, I guess, a platform, like a forum, I don't, whatever, like I put platform in quotes in my notes. We need to provide a platform for the public, for anybody that wants to do research or that wants to, in a weekend, try to hack his car, the same way that most of people that were like, I remember when I was younger to just like play around with my computer, trying to install a GUI and hack them and blah, blah, blah to make them work the way I wanted. There should be an easier way to show this information to other people and make sure that those algorithm manufacturers want that to happen. And right now we are far away from that. Two other examples of what I'm trying to say here is, after those findings, car manufacturers like for example, the Fiat Chrysler Automotive released a patch in the few days after the or a little bit before the article was published, but they didn't want to attribute the findings to those two researchers. They just say, oh, we have a patch, it fixed that problem. And they, like, when they were pressed about it, they kind of said, yeah, we worked ish with them and we thanked them, but that's it. And a more, let's say an old case, like, researcher in the Netherlands in 2012 found a security flaw in the common chip used in Volkswagen cars' keys to make sure that those cars doesn't start with any keys that you just copied from a key shop. And they were sued by the Volkswagen group to not make their findings public. And funny enough, after a year of negotiation with Volkswagen, they were able to publish a redacted version of their paper. And I will let you guess what was the edit.
Let me guess. Like, the names of the cars that are impacted?
That's a good guess, but the article I found didn't mention it. They just say, they deleted a single sentence from the report.
What the fuck?
Exactly. Like, they fought for a year in court to get the sentence removed.
Huh. That's weird.
And then... And then they're the one complaining when, like, vulnerability gets exposed, and then, like, no, don't expose them, don't go, like, and they say to those researchers, don't go to conference, speak about them, because you can be held responsible, unquote, for the life of people that are put in danger. Like, those people are not the one that wrote the fucking code and that shipped those cars with those bugs. Those are the ones that are trying to do the good thing, and they are mostly Like, I don't want to generalize. There will be people, or there, I'm sure there has been people that found those vulnerabilities and don't say a word about it and just use them for their own good, aka just, I don't know, extort money from people, whatever. They just use it in a bad way. But right now, there are people that want to improve the situation and they're not able to do so because either they are getting sued or it's still a little bit like underground. Like, it's really nice that those two researchers were able to publish their research paper on Twitter, for example. It's really nice and they have a big follower. But at the same time, like, not everybody can attend this like security conference where most of those talk happened. Like, there's still, in my opinion, there's still like kind of a black box around what's happening in the security industry. Because, and I could see why, because those people are talking about stuff that maybe the public should not know that much. Like, it could be good for the public to know that there's tons of vulnerability and that people should fix them. But it might be better for the greater good that this particular vulnerability should not be out, because in some cases it could kill people.
Right. Well, computer security is just a touchy subject in general, because like, you want to argue most of the time towards computer security, but at the same time you look at like something like Touch ID, which is very, very contentious in the community, because you have, on the one hand, you have people like me who really want to use Touch ID because it is more convenient than having to type in a password, and if you were to try to brute force my fingerprint basically until you guessed it, you would have to go through a lot of combinations. But of course the immediate retort to that is, well, I can just use like a photocopier or whatever and a certain kind of paper and essentially clone your fingertips if you're with me. But the way I see things is, as soon as you get physical access to the device, you're screwed anyway. So I'm not losing much. Like, anyone who gets physical access to my device is probably, if they have a bad intention, going to end up getting to my data anyway. So I'm not that worried about that as much as I am about a random person picking up my phone and then looking at my data. Like an untargeted attack, basically. Or stuff like passwords. Like, we were talking earlier this week on Twitter, well, not you and I, but someone else, about Windows 10 has unlock your computer with a smile, facial recognition features, and biometrics in general. They're just this very polarizing thing, because you have, like, in an ideal world, this is less secure than passwords, so we shouldn't be using it. But on the other hand, we're not in that ideal world, and the average user uses the same password everywhere, and their password is probably in a leaked database from a hack somewhere, and obvious to anyone who looks it up in that database and can just get into every account that they already have. So their security is already compromised, so for them to use the smile technique is more secure than the no security that they're already in. Basically, security is relative to how well you are using what's available to you, and if you suck at passwords, then pretty much anything is better than you're sucking at passwords. But security people that are so minded on you need to have a different password everywhere, it needs to be 30 characters or more everywhere and all that stuff, they don't see that because they know the best practices. But if you think like a common person, your evaluation on what is secure may come out completely different in practice. And I think that there's sort of a lack of that kind of pragmatism in computer security spaces, and at the same time that kind of pragmatism pisses off the pure security people because they know it's less secure, right? So I think there's always like this tug of war within companies about computer security. And the other thing is, I think that the computer security space in general is much more open than you're giving it credit for. The problem is, it's not an accessible vocabulary. It's all in hacker terms that hackers will understand. And if they know where to look, they will find the information. But like, unless you are a security researcher that is working for a publication and can write things in accessible vocabulary that everyone can understand, the common person or Joe whoever at your local TV station who is in charge of tech news who doesn't know shit isn't going to actually explain the issue correctly. And then that leads to panic or not caring, basically.
Yeah, and at that point, we need a Don Oliver on each country to say, like, does the government can see my dick and explain the same using this kit with the Edward Snowden. I don't know if you've seen this one.
Yeah, I have. What okay, we need good. Is so, InfoSec Taylor Swift to write a song about like everything that is wrong in the world.
That would be too much indeed. And can you can you really imagine like the real Taylor Swift sing about InfoSec?
Well, it depends, because maybe InfoSec Taylor Swift is the real Taylor Swift.
Oh, that's the right answer. That's the right answer. So now
I secretly hope it is.
And if we go back to on the subject for a bit. So I feel pretty cynical about this. And Yannick touched a point about like maybe my frustration about it not being public enough is because I don't have the eyes to look at it, if you see what I mean. Because people that know how to look at it are looking at the right places. And that is the counterargument of this point. It's just like, if by being more public, it brings more risk of exposing those features. And you don't want to be in a situation like Adobe Flash, where some kind of like rogue security company were able to use exploit on Flash to hack on governments. You don't want to have that for cars, where, yes, if it's Adobe Flash, you can get government leaks. But if it's car, guns, trains, whatever, planes, where hacking them could just kill people. That's another, in my opinion, that's another step.
I think the fact that hacking cars can kill people just puts this on another level, because earlier when you were talking about like during the weekend, you can hack your own computer. It's like, yeah, but your computer isn't going to kill you if you screw something up. Whereas if you give people user-friendly tools, or even just reasonably user-friendly tools, because it's very hard to find actual user-friendly tools for InfoSec stuff, it's like not really a good idea, at least if you can control the car. Like, if you can see everything that is going on inside the car, I'm fine with a view only, but it's as soon as you sort of do like a read-write relationship that stuff gets really dangerous, because then you can sort of hijack your neighbor's car if you don't like him and then make him run into a bush somewhere.
And then if you're good enough, you can just say, I don't know what happened. This guy was trying to drive, and for a reason, he tried to run in front of me and then crash his car in my house, for example. And then voila, you have the perfect crime.
Yeah, I guess he just rolled on a banana peel or something with his car.
Yeah, I guess.
It's Mario Kart in the street.
So yeah, that topic was like, captivated my curiosity so much in the recent weeks, but at the same time, it was strange that it didn't like made me that much sad and resentful about those findings, especially when I was saying like that maybe sometimes the current market is not improving itself enough and all of that stuff. Like, it's really interesting that there are tons of good people that are looking about that right now. There are doing research, and there's like, in a way, public money, because if, as far as I know, some of those researchers that I mentioned were backed by public money. So there's still like the public eye looking on that. And this is what gives me hope that in the future, like knowledge and public knowledge on those issues will help. And also obviously competition will help to improve the market as a whole. And let's hope that in 10 years, we might have more secure cars and maybe self-driving cars, which will make me sad, but that's for another time.
Well, I'd like to propose a solution. It might not be perfect, but I think it's a start. And that is, similar to how cars have crash testing, they should go through security audits before they're allowed to be sold.
That could be part of the solution.
I mean, if you get the people who are responsible for these hacks to basically sit together in a room and come up with what are the minimum requirements for what we believe to be a secure system within a car for something like that, I think it would be very interesting to have that be a requirement at the national level when you buy a car that has these kinds of networking features built in. Of course, if you're buying like a dumb car that has no networking, then who cares? But
yeah, and now that you mention it, I'm trying to imagine a world where, remember those crash ratings?
Yeah, yeah.
You could have the same maybe not security ratings, because like a car that is not secure is kind of weird to say, but maybe to say like this car respects the standard, this car excel above the standards, for example, or stuff like that. Like maybe not like a 4-star crash report or stuff like that, but maybe like more not vague, but more general to say like we have a default level of standard. And
well, do sort of like what the environmental checklists are, and just have like EPEAT gold, EPEAT silver. Well, do that for like security, where you have this checklist of things that you go check for, and have it be constantly updating to keep up with what the latest best practices in security are. And if you find any loopholes or whatever, add them to the checklist. But basically have tiers of security ratings that you can assign to cars, and people can go look them up when they're shopping for a new car, and then they can make the judgment for themselves if they value networking security in their car, which is maybe the weirdest thing I've said this month. But
yeah, indeed. And it will just... Can you imagine for a sec Top Gear, which says, so today we'll talk about those four cars. So we have this CarSec Bronze, CarSelc Silver model, and Car Security Gold Platinum model, which suck at driving, but it's really secure. But the bronze one is really good. You can drift with it. You can have fun on the track, but really sucks at security.
Or like you open up a car, you open up a car magazine that they're using port scanners on the cars.
Yeah, this will be a strange future.
Yeah, I don't think the car industry is going to take it as seriously as we are, but we can always hope.
And that was it for my security and Internet of Things / car topic.
Interesting. I actually thought of one of the Internet of Things things that I might actually be tempted to get, and that Ooh. Is the Bluetooth scale, because sort of a pain. I can see like health-related things where you sort of don't get access to actual physical devices in my house that do things, but instead you get health data randomly. I think that's less of a risk for within the house, security wise. Like, I don't really care if people know how much I weigh. But yeah, that's pretty much the only thing I can think of that I actually care about.
Yeah, I haven't thought of like health devices as a whole. And it's funny now that I'm looking at the time with my Apple Watch. But yeah, those devices are also included in maybe like health automation, if we want to call it this way. And I would put it at the same risk as maybe like, okay, if somebody hacks my light, I can just plug it, like disable the internet and that's it. And it will still work. Like the risk of a hack happen on those kind of platform is just a burden or inconvenience. It's not life threatening.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that's it. Yeah, that's it.
All right. So you can find the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/21. You can also find the show as a whole at limitlesspossibility.net. We're also on Twitter at limipo_podcast.
And this week I mentioned tons of links that I would strongly suggest you to go take a look. So go on a website and take a look at those show notes. You can also find Yannick on Twitter at
Sakurina, Sakurina.
And you can find myself on Twitter at Lukonoche, Lucconoche.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.